Tari and six other public figures are facing a legal bill of more than £34 million over their failed case against the publisher of the Daily Mail. A High Court judge said the way they'd presented their claims was unreasonable to a high degree. The BBC understands the Duchess of Sussex is in talks about appearing in a Netflix comedy about a duke who becomes a drug baron. A daytime Russian drone attack on a shopping centre in central Ukraine has killed at least 15 people. A six-year-old girl has died in hospital days after she was pulled from the sea at Shoreham. Her parents and older sister also died when they all got into difficulty. Joe Root has led England's cricketers to an emphatic win over Pakistan in his first test back as captain. Prince Harry and six other household names are facing a possible bill of more than £34 million after a High Court judge roundly attacked the way they'd brought their privacy case against the publisher of the Daily Mail. The case, that Associated Newspapers Limited engaged in unlawful information gathering, was dismissed last month. Now the Prince, alongside Sir Elton John, Liz Hurtley and Baroness Doreen Lawrence, have been ordered to make an interim payment of more than £9.5 million to cover the newspaper group's legal costs. Our Home and Legal correspondent Dominic Casciani reports.
When Prince Harry and six other claimants emphatically lost their case against the Daily Mail Group last month, the Duke described the result as a complete and obvious whitewash. Weeks later, Associated Newspapers said those words proved how unreasonable the case had been from the start, and the group deserved to recover every penny of the £34.5 million it said it spent defending itself. This afternoon, Mr Justice Nicklin said the newspaper group had faced unsupported claims that executives had lied to the Leveson Public Inquiry into press ethics, and a key witness, a private detective, had been discredited. Other allegations had fallen apart over the four-year battle. The Mail, he ruled, was therefore entitled to try to claim many millions more than the pre-trial cap of £16 million. Colin Campbell is a former expert costs judge.
I was surprised that the judge permitted the Daily Mail to pursue all its costs against the claimants, not just those that the court had previously budgeted. But there is some hope for the claimants. Firstly, their evidence was found to be honest and measured, and secondly, that the judge was scathing in his judgment that the costs at £34.5 million now claimed by the Daily Mail are so high.
Insurance covers that first £16 million. A year or more will now be spent arguing over the next £18 million. David Yelland, a former editor of The Sun turned PR guru, said the Duke and Duchess of Sussex now had to find a way to get ahead of this crisis as they return to the UK.
From the point of view of Harry and Meghan, they need to get the oxygen out of this news story. There are 15 pages this morning in the Daily Mail on this story. Not all entirely negative, but I would say 14 pages out of 15 negative. There was a really big challenge here.
There's been no word today from Prince Harry, but Associated Newspapers says the ruling was a devastating critique of an attempt to destroy a newspaper and the reputations of its journalists, editors and executives. The truth is, it said, these outrageous claims should never have been brought.
The BBC has been told the Duchess of Sussex is in talks to appear in a TV series being made by Netflix. There's been speculation that a return to her former acting career is one of the reasons Meghan and Prince Harry are moving back to the UK with their young children. Here's our senior royal correspondent, Daniela Ralph.
The BBC has learnt that the Duchess of Sussex is in talks to appear in the Netflix series The Gentleman, created by the British film director Guy Ritchie. Discussions are in their early stages, but this would be the first significant acting role for Meghan since her marriage to Prince Harry. The Gentleman is a comedy series about a duke who becomes a drug baron. Much of the two previous series of the show have been filmed in the Cotswolds, close to where it's rumoured Harry and Meghan will set up home in the UK. Although the details of a possible role for Meghan have not been revealed, it's becoming increasingly clear that her return to acting has been an important part of the family decision to come back to the UK.
Ukrainian officials say at least 14 people have been killed and more than 100 injured in a Russian attack on a shopping centre in the city of Kryvyi Riha in the middle of the afternoon. President Zelensky said drones struck in two waves, the second coming half an hour after the first, and called the attack despicable. He said his country would definitely respond. Our Ukraine correspondent Dan Johnson sent this report from Kyiv.
Footage shows a drone diving towards the already burning shopping centre. Despite attempts to shoot it down, it then hit the building. People are reported trapped beneath rubble and rescue teams are searching. President Zelensky, who's from Kryvyi Rih, said the strike was absolutely cynical and despicable. He added the second drone struck half an hour after the first, targeting emergency workers. More than 100 people were wounded, dozens seriously, local officials say, and at least 11 children are reported to have been hurt.
The Food Standards Agency has issued a warning about the risks posed by undercooked eggs during the current salmonella outbreak. It says young children, people over 65, pregnant women and others who are vulnerable should avoid runny or uncooked eggs when dining out or eating takeaways. One person has died in what officials say is an unusually large outbreak of salmonella, and more than 200 people have fallen ill. The source has not been identified, but it's believed to be linked to imported rather than British eggs. Our health editor Hugh Pym has more.
The Food Standards Agency and the UK Health Security Agency have made clear that British eggs are safe to eat and those sold in shops are not affected by the outbreak. They say it's very probably linked to imported eggs. There have been 207 cases reported so far and one death. In a BBC interview, Professor Ian Young, chief scientific advisor at the FSA, said there was important advice for the vulnerable, the over 65s, young children, pregnant women and those with underlying health conditions.
It's important to make sure that any eggs or egg products that you consume in those settings have been very well cooked. And our advice is to people to avoid the soft boiled eggs, the soft poached eggs, and in addition, mousses, souffles, hollandaise sauce, things like that which might contain uncooked eggs.
Experts believe the impact on people's health varies. Dr. Gary Godbole is an official at the UK Health Security Agency.
A vast majority of people affected have had mild illness with diarrhea, vomiting and a fever, and have gotten better quite quickly. And around 38% of individuals have required hospital care.
An egg industry spokesperson said many restaurants and cafes used British eggs, which were safe for all customers, and they should just ask the source. The FSA said the advice applied across the UK, though a significant majority of the reported salmonella cases were in England. Officials have acknowledged there will probably be more cases and that the task of identifying the precise source of the infections will take a while longer.
Emma Mosey owns Yoke Farm in North Yorkshire, which also has an egg restaurant on site. She explains the types of restaurants that sell imported eggs.
The issue probably with catering, and I would say that this is not a general thing. I wouldn't say that the majority of restaurants would be using imported eggs. But sometimes if a wholesaler can't get hold of local eggs or they're looking at cost, they might import eggs. And the restaurant might not even know that they are purchasing imported eggs because they might just be ordering eggs.
A six-year-old girl who was rescued from the water at Shoreham-on-Sea on Tuesday has died in hospital. Saja El-Khawassi's mother, father and older sister Sarah all died during the incident in Shoreham. Here's our UK correspondent, Daniel Sanford.
It was on Tuesday afternoon that four members of the British-Palestinian family from London got into difficulty in the water near the old fort at Shoreham-on-Sea in West Sussex. There was a huge emergency response involving a lifeboat, the Coast Guard, ambulances, police and helicopters. Despite the rescue efforts, Hassan El-Khawas, his wife Zaina Alain and their 14-year-old daughter Sarah all died. Her younger sister, 6-year-old Saja, survived and was taken to hospital in a critical condition. But Sussex police have confirmed that she has now also died. The force said that after looking at CCTV footage and talking to eyewitnesses, they currently think the deaths were a tragic accident. They're continuing to investigate and will prepare a file for the coroner.
The Met Office has warned that next year could be the hottest on record globally, caused in part by the El Niño developing in the Pacific, likely to be the strongest in living memory. The natural climate phenomenon pushes up global temperatures and can increase the risks of extreme weather. The effects of this El Niño event are already being felt in some parts of the world, as our environment correspondent Matt McGrath reports.
In Peru this week, the famous Machu Picchu tourist trail closed because of flooding, said to be linked to a strengthening El Niño. This is the naturally occurring pattern that shifts weather across the globe. Scientists are growing ever more concerned that this year's event will be exceptionally strong with widespread impacts. Professor Adam Scaife is the Met Office's head of long-range forecasting.
I have never seen an event like this in our forecasts. The tropical Pacific is warming faster than I've ever seen. We think that when it peaks in November and December, it's likely to be record event, unprecedented beyond anything we've seen in living memory.
In Panama, drought has drained the freshwater lakes which feed the shipping canal, forcing authorities to cut the number of vessels passing through. And the effects are already reaching people's pockets. India, the world's second biggest sugar producer, is now importing for the first time in a decade. A weak monsoon has hit production, and prices have jumped 40% in 2 months. And it's not just food that's likely to be impacted. The same global weather turmoil could push up energy prices too. Professor Amanda Maycock is from the University of Leeds.
I think we're definitely looking at the compound effect of different influences from a weather and a climate perspective. You know, the prices of things like liquid natural gas imports and so on can be affected by demand that's happening elsewhere in the world, which may well be affected by the El Niño if there are droughts in certain regions. Reductions in the production of hydroelectricity, for example, in places like Brazil, that could have a knock-on effect for us here in the UK.
The effects depend on where you are in the globe. As mentioned, a weaker monsoon in India, but for the UK, the prediction is for more rain in a wetter, stormier autumn. El Niño itself is a naturally occurring event, and there's no clear evidence that climate change is making it stronger. But it's arriving in an already warmer world, and that, scientists say, is what will sharpen its impacts. With all the extra heat it's set to release from the ocean into the atmosphere, next year is very likely to be the hottest ever recorded.
A woman has appeared in court charged with aggravated arson in relation to a big moorland fire in Greater Manchester last month. Shania Kerr Slade, who's 20, pleaded not guilty but admitted a charge of dangerous driving. She's due to stand trial for arson next year. The fire at Dovestone Reservoir was declared a major incident, which has not stood down until 3 weeks later. Football's world governing body, FIFA, has imposed a series of punishments on the Argentine men's team for incidents at this summer's World Cup. Some players posed with a banner referencing the Falklands after they played England. There was a flare-up on the pitch after Argentina were beaten by Spain in the final. Manny Jasmine reports.
In all, Argentina's players and staff have been banned for a combined total of 21 games. The midfielder Leandro Paredes will miss their next 10 after he appeared to grab a Spanish opponent by the throat and throw another to the ground at the end of the final, which Spain won by 1-0. The defender Nahuel Molina is suspended for 7 games. He appeared to hit the former Manchester City midfielder Rodri in the stomach while he was celebrating Spain's victory. The Argentine Football Association has been fined around £235,000 for demonstrations of a non-sporting nature after their players celebrated beating England by waving a banner saying Las Malvinas, what they call the Falkland Islands, belongs to Argentina. Argentina must also spend £73,000 on an anti-discrimination plan as punishment for what FIFA says was discrimination and racist abuse by their fans, and the stadium for their next home match must have a capacity reduced by 50%.
A senior United Nations official has warned that the Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo is growing exponentially, with more than 2,500 deaths now recorded. Julian Harness, the UN's Ebola coordinator, says half of those deaths have been in the past 20 days. From Nairobi, here's Richard Kagoe.
The Democratic Republic of Congo is struggling to contain its biggest Ebola outbreak. Speaking from Bunia in Ituri province, the center of the outbreak, Julian Hannes warned that the virus could spread further, including to neighboring countries. He says more staff and resources are needed in remote areas of Eastern DRC to slow transmission. He also warned that aid funding could run out within weeks.
The epidemic is spreading to an area that is bigger than France, and the outbreak is growing faster and wider than the Ebola response. Basic services, particularly health, have been fragmented. The operating conditions are brutal.
The virus has been detected in six provinces where health systems have been weakened by years of armed conflict. There are now more than 5,000 cases, including at least 800 children.
The US Supreme Court has said that work to construct the new ballroom in the White House can continue for now. The court will continue to consider a challenge which is aiming to halt President Trump's project entirely. He has welcomed the court's announcement, but the Heritage Group, which wants the work to be stopped, has noted that this is not a final ruling. Our State Department correspondent Tom Bateman reports.
President Trump ordered the demolition of the White House's historic East Wing last year, beginning construction of a massive ballroom he said would be the greatest of its kind ever built. The legal challenge came from the National Trust for Historic Preservation. Today's ruling from the Supreme Court doesn't address the legality of the project, which two other courts had said was unlawful because Congress hadn't approved it. Rather, it is meant to give the justices more time to consider Mr. Trump's request. In the meantime, construction can continue on the ballroom, involving a 250-person crew working 20-hour days, 7 days a week, which Mr. Trump argues is also a security necessity owing to the project's underground bunkers and anti-drone protections. To his critics, Mr. Trump's ballroom has become a symbol of his second term, the demolition of a federal structure without permission and a president pushing through the boundaries of his authority before Congress has a chance to challenge him.
The family of Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan say they remain concerned about his health due to isolation in prison, despite him being declared medically fit by doctors after a short hospital visit. He's 3 years into a jail term for corruption, charges which his supporters say are politically motivated. From Islamabad, here's our Pakistan correspondent, Caroline Davis.
Imran Khan has not been seen in public for more than 3 years. Until Tuesday, his family hadn't seen him in person for months. While this week's sudden court order to send him to hospital was met with concern, there was also some excitement by his followers that they could catch a glimpse or hear some news of their leader. Mr. Khan was sent to a state-run hospital, not the one specified by the court. The government said that this was necessary because of the security situation caused by Mr. Khan's supporters. Both his family and the authorities have said Mr. Khan is physically fit, but his sister, Dr. Uzma Khan, told a news conference isolation in prison was causing anxiety and high blood pressure.
He keeps saying the same thing, that he has been mistreated and mentally tortured. He says that for around 10 months he has not been given any reading material or access to television, and that another doctor told him that his health was being affected because of lack of human contact.
The brief hospital visit and an order that he should be allowed weekly visits with his family was a significant intervention by the court. Some believe that it came after manoeuvrings between his party and the politically powerful military. Neither side has commented, meaning many are watching for clues about what might happen next.
Palestinian officials say a 17-year-old boy has died after being shot in the chest during clashes with Israeli settlers in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli military has confirmed that a security official opened fire in an area where it says Palestinians were throwing stones at Israeli civilians who were in the area without authorization. Israeli settlements are illegal under international law. Andy Burnham has said the whole country stands with those affected by terrorism as he made commitments to improve support for survivors and bereaved families. The Prime Minister was speaking at a memorial event marking the UK's first National Day for victims and survivors of terrorism. Our correspondent Nick Johnson was there.
Today has been a long time coming. Survivors of terror attacks have been campaigning for a National Day of Recognition for many years. Among those at today's ceremony, Thelma Stober, who was seriously injured in the 7/7 bombings in London in 2005. She says survivors like herself have been given a backseat.
It wasn't prioritised, you know, the needs of victims and survivors and families of bereaved, the need for recognition wasn't recognised as something of a top priority, frankly.
Survivors say there's still more to be done. Brendan Cox is the widower of the murdered Labour MP Joe Cox. He says the compensation scheme for terror victims is letting them down.
The process around compensation is insulting, it's demeaning. The government know it doesn't work. They know it's not a system fit for purpose, yet they still haven't reformed it. We know that you can only claim for the top three injuries, for example, when many of the survivors have got hundreds of injuries all around their body.
Survivors had been hoping a prominent national figure would join them today to draw attention to their shared experience. Speaking at the end of the ceremony, the Prime Minister said the government would look at reforming the compensation scheme. Andy Burnham also pledged to consult victims and survivors of terrorism about creating a permanent national memorial. Survivors will want to make sure his words are backed up by action.
A man has appeared in court accused of failing to disclose information relating to the attack on the Heaton Park Synagogue in Manchester in October. Two worshippers died. The attacker was shot dead by police. 49-year-old Hekmat Omar Ali Hakim, who's an Iraqi national living in Salford, indicated he would plead not guilty. He was remanded in custody ahead of a hearing at the Old Bailey next month. Official figures show that the government borrowed more money than expected last month. The Office for National Statistics said increased bills for the state pension and benefits pushed borrowing in July to £1.8 billion, when many analysts had thought there could be a surplus. Economists believe the news shows that the Chancellor has little scope to increase borrowing at his first budget in October. Here's our business correspondent, Mark Ashdown.
July is typically a strong month for the government balance sheet as self-assessed income tax receipts roll in. They amounted to £17 billion in July, £1.7 billion more than last year. But the amount being spent on debt interest, public services, benefits and state pensions has continued to outstrip the government's income. Borrowing, to bridge that gap, stands at £56.7 billion for the first 4 months of the fiscal year, £2.3 billion above the Office for Budget Responsibility forecast. And at 94%, debt as a percentage of GDP has fallen marginally compared with last year, but remained at levels last seen in the early 1960s. Economists have warned that the figures will restrict the Chancellor John Healey's options as he weighs up his first budget in October. Mr Healey said the government was trying to ease cost of living pressures and get young people into work. The Conservatives said more money was being spent on debt interest than on defence, police and prisons combined.
Now for a look at the morning papers. The Daily Mail splashes on the judge's ruling about costs in Prince Harry's failed privacy claim against the paper's publishers, Associated Newspapers. The Day of Reckoning, the paper calls it, saying the claimants, including Prince Harry and Elton John, will now have to pay millions to the Mail. The Times says the ruling threatens to overshadow the Sussexes' announcement that they'll soon return to Britain. The Daily Telegraph reports that the criminal investigation into whether Lord Mandelson passed confidential government information to Jeffrey Epstein is at risk of collapse. Scotland Yard detectives are said to think it's unlikely they'll receive the necessary files from the US Department of Justice. According to The Guardian, MPs have accepted almost £400,000 worth of hospitality to concerts and sporting events this year. The paper said they'd failed to learn lessons from the outcry when Sir Keir Starmer accepted football tickets and clothing in 2024. Labour said declarations had been in line with parliamentary rules. Joe Root has made a triumphant start to his second stint as England captain. His side won the first test against Pakistan at Headingley by an innings and 103 runs.
Archer into Bolt. Mohammed Abbas gives himself some room and clubs this high in the air. He's going to be caught. A backward point he is. It's all over. Pakistan outplayed from the first ball to the last ball. An emphatic victory for Joe Root and his team. And it's done before tea on the third day.
England can now seal the series win in next week's test at Lord's. Eleanor Oldroyd was watching in Leeds.
Victory for England by an innings, comfortably within 3 days, an emphatic start to Joe Root's second spell as captain. Pakistan were poor, a shadow of great teams of the past, but that doesn't detract from England's superiority with bat, ball and in the field. Pakistan were batting before midday, England having added 43 to their overnight score to give themselves a 238-run first innings lead. Jofra Archer dismissed both openers, with Pakistan again losing a wicket before they had a run on the board. Josh Tung's burst of 3 wickets in 11 balls after lunch ripped the heart out of the innings. He and Ollie Robinson both ended the game with 8 wickets, Archer taking the final one half an hour before tea was scheduled. After a torrid few months of renewal, with coach and captain both replaced, England will be bursting with confidence, 1-0 up going to Lord's for the second game in the series next week.
In football, England have announced their squad for the Under-20s Women's World Cup. The tournament takes place in Poland next month, with 6 European nations taking part. UEFA, European football's governing body, has threatened to boycott all FIFA competitions because of Gianni Infantino's plans to sell stakes to investors. Emma Saunders reports.
There is still uncertainty about the participation of the England team in this tournament. UEFA and its member countries have threatened to boycott all FIFA competitions, including this one, which is only a couple of weeks away, because of an ongoing dispute about the FIFA Forward Enterprise proposal. The FIFA president, Gianni Infantino, had hoped to create a new company which would have allowed 21% of all FIFA competitions, including World Cups, to be sold to a private investment company. It was aborted after a backlash from across the world of football, but UEFA still wants reassurances that the proposal will never return. So for the moment, the squad will continue with its preparations, but the staff are still not sure. Players will be taken to the field in Poland on the 5th of September for their opening match against Canada.
In the first Premier League match of the season, the defending champions Arsenal beat Coventry 3-0 at the Emirates. The Arsenal captain, Martin Ødegaard, said it was a perfect start and his side wanted to fight for the title again. The fastest man in history, the Jamaican sprinter Usain Bolt, has registered to play for a veteran Sunday League football team in Manchester. The 40-year-old has signed up for Withenshaw Vets FC, who play in the Premier Division of the Cheshire Veterans Football League. It's not just a normal team. Its squad for the coming season already includes the former England internationals Emil Heskey and Jolyon Lescott. A collection of handwritten notes by the Indian independence leader Mahatma Gandhi has been sold at auction for more than £1 million. The sale in Mumbai sets a record for the highest price paid for an Indian historical document. Here's our Global Affairs reporter, Joanna Keane.
Known as the father of the nation, Mahatma Gandhi led India's struggle against British rule. These notes offer a personal insight into the political leader's thinking in the 1940s, the decade in which India became independent. The messages, written over a 2-year period to a close associate, reflect on truth, non-violence and self-restraint. The collection was later compiled into a book called A Thought for the Day. The identity of the buyer hasn't been revealed, but the auction house says the notes will remain in India. Although the messages were the highlight of the sale, other personal items that went under the hammer included Mahatma Gandhi's portable spinning wheel and 2 letters about the spiritual discipline of spinning.
A biography of Sir Keir Starmer has become one of the latest additions to the Downing Street Library, after being donated by the former Prime Minister himself. The collection was established almost a century ago by the first Labour Prime Minister, Ramsay MacDonald. 7 other members of Sir Keir's government also contributed books, though none were about themselves. Our political correspondent, Damien Grammaticus, has been reading up on the story.
The Downing Street Library holds just over 400 books. All were donated over the past century by former leaders and cabinet ministers who chose them because they were special or politically significant to them. A BBC Freedom of Information request has revealed that Sir Keir Starmer's choice was Keir Starmer, the Biography, written by the former journalist Tom Baldwin. It's thought to be the only one in the collection about a donor which they didn't pen themselves. Clement McIntyre is Professor of Politics at Adelaide University and has done extensive research on the library.
I think what we see is a Prime Minister who's donating something about his time and his rise in politics. And there are lots of Prime Ministers who've given accounts of their own political lives. And Starmer hasn't yet written an autobiography, so maybe one day that will appear in the library.
Those who have given their own autobiographies, memoirs or collections of speeches stretch from Winston Churchill and Clement Attlee to David Cameron and Margaret Thatcher. Boris Johnson gave a book he wrote about Winston Churchill. Edward Heath donated books he'd written about sailing and music, while former ministers have left works by other authors, ranging from histories or novels, such as the political thriller House of Cards, to works about wine, travel and gardening, each giving an insight into their own individual and idiosyncratic thinking, passions and politics.
The headlines again. Prince Harry and six other public figures are facing a legal bill of more than £34 million over their failed case against the publisher of the Daily Mail. Emergency workers in Ukraine are searching rubble for any survivors of a Russian drone attack on a shopping centre. 16 people were killed. A six-year-old girl who lost three members of her family when they all got into difficulties in the sea in Shoreham has died in hospital. The Food Standards Agency is warning pregnant women and young children to avoid undercooked eggs when eating out because of a risk of salmonella. BBC News.
With Chris Aldridge. Now, with a look at the weather, it's Stampton AOS. Hello.
Hi, good morning to you. Temperatures have been coming down over the past few days, along with some scattered showers as low pressure moved south across the UK, introducing cooler air from northern climes. Temperatures on Friday afternoon reached a high of 23.3 Celsius in Newport in Shropshire, this much closer to the average for the time of year. Now, this weekend, it will remain on the cool side, with temperatures below average for many on Saturday, before recovering slightly on Sunday as we head into Monday. Nights will remain chilly, with mist and fog patches in places. Now, tonight, high pressure continues to build in from the west. Most places will be dry as any showers fade, although a few light showers could continue around coastal areas of England and Wales. Clear spells will develop widely, though, with winds becoming lighter away from North Sea coast. It'll be a chilly night with lows of 6 to 9 Celsius for many, falling down to 3 to 5 Celsius in sheltered parts of Scotland and northern England, but coastal areas will be milder at around 10 to 13 Celsius. Saturday will start dry and clear in most places, but chilly with single figures widely. Now, most areas will stay dry with sunny spells, although cloud will tend to bubble up through the afternoon to bring a few light showers, particularly across southwest England and parts of eastern Yorkshire and Lincolnshire. Northwest Scotland may also see a few scattered showers and more cloud into the afternoon. Winds will be lighter with highs of 16 to 19 Celsius across the north, 19 to 22 across the south, so still slightly below the average for the time of year. Sunday brings another cool start with mist and fog patches possible. Most areas will be dry with sunny spells. I think we'll see more sunshine around on Sunday, but patchy cloud will develop again across some northern and eastern areas with the best of the sunshine across southern England. Temperatures will recover 16 to 20 Celsius across Scotland and Northern Ireland, 19